In 2024 heb je nog 6 kansen om mijn show Stormbrein te komen zien. Donderdag 21 november in de Schouwburg van Van Rij. Vrijdag 22 november in het Zaantheater in Zaandam. Zaterdag 23 november, dan ga ik Van Berenstein in Veendam. Donderdag 28 november sta ik in Dok 6 in Panningen. En zaterdag 30 in de Schouwburg van Amstelveen. De laatste mogelijkheid dit jaar is op vrijdag 13 december in het Isala Theater in Capelle aan de IJssel. Info tickets vind je via woutermonde.nl en daar kan je natuurlijk ook even aanmelden voor de nieuwsbrief. Welkom, mijn naam is Wouter Monde en dit is de Elektra Podcast. Een podcast waarin ik met collega's herinneringen ophaal aan shows die ze liever waren vergeten. Genoemd naar het roemruchte jongerencentrum Elektra in Sliedrecht, dat ooit bekend stond als de Comedy Hell. Dit gesprek is in het Engels. Maar ik heb als test met behulp van kunstmatige intelligentie ook een Nederlandse versie gemaakt. Dat is een beetje onnatuurlijk en ook zeker niet foutloos, maar wel handig voor als je liever in het Nederlands luistert. Je vindt die aflevering in de podcast-app waar je ook deze aflevering luistert. Ik ben benieuwd wat je daarvan vindt.
I'm not like a flag waver, you know, rah-rah America guy. The sound man, when I was introduced, he played God Bless America. So this already rabid anti-American audience lost their minds before I even got to the microphone. They're just like, fuck America, go back to America, fuck America.
In deze aflevering praat ik via een online verbinding met Tom Rhodes, comedian. Tom begon ruim 40 jaar geleden als comedian in Amerika en hij toert inmiddels over de hele wereld. Hij woonde en werkte ook lange tijd in Nederland. Je kent hem misschien nog wel als de host van de Kevin Masters Show starring Tom Rhodes. Tom is nog regelmatig in Nederland te zien. In november 2024 doet hij zelfs een tour met solovoorstellingen in verschillende theaters. In de omschrijving van deze aflevering vind je een linkje naar alle data. Heel veel plezier! Dit is de Elektra Podcast met Tom Rhodes. And you started out when you were 17. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. I had a fake ID to get into the club. So my career started as a criminal act. But I wanted to be a comedian since I was 11. My uncle did open mic night comedy in Washington, D.C. when I was 11. And my father took me to see him. And we entered the entrance was by the stage and the show was in progress. And I was wearing a Washington Redskins jacket, the football team of Washington, D.C. And the comedian on stage pulled me on stage and he introduced me, like interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins. So that moment changed my life forever, to stand on that stage and see all these happy people with their heads thrown back in laughter. And D.C. is a very diverse city, so it was all the flavors of humanity. And I never, ever considered doing anything else from that moment onward. So when I started when I was 17, I actually thought I was starting kind of late. Yeah.
That's a consolation. I started when I was 30 and I thought I was really late. But do you remember what it was like to be on stage when you were 11 or 12? Because that's a really young age and it can be very intimidating, but you thought, no, this is what
I thought it was
do.
The coolest thing ever. And then we watched the rest of the show from the bar with sipping Cokes. And I just thought these comedians were wizards of great power to go on stage and make people laugh, and I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And then I became a student of stand-up comedy and would watch all the HBO specials and comedians on Johnny Carson and all the late night talk shows. And there used to be a TV guide and it would come once a week, and I would look through it and I would circle when there was to be a comedian on any talk show. So I would be sitting in front of the television watching the comedians, you know? I always thought they dressed cool. you know, the topics. I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And I still do. My opinion has not changed.
Yeah, and I understand, and I think you're right. But then when you start out yourself, then you start out doing open mics, which are not at all like how you see comedy on TV and how you see comedians perform on a late night talk show. Was it?
In high school, I started hosting the talent shows and the pep rallies. And so I had a little practice that way, but, you know, it was the adult nightclub world. So first of all, it was exciting being in this taboo world I wasn't old enough to get into. And it was Florida in the 1980s. So, you know, there was lots of cocaine everywhere, which I was terrified of, and lots of partying. And I thought it was pretty exciting. I mean, I wasn't into the, I could see the older comedians doing cocaine and stuff, and I saw a few of them just lose their mind from it. So at that time, I didn't want anything to do with it. But, I was still a pretty fresh-faced high school kid. You know, I was still on the high school baseball team and stuff. It was great. It was, to get laughs, and, you know, the first couple times were terrifying, and half the jokes didn't work, and I would just, you know, be obsessed with trying to write better jokes. And it's really exciting when any comedian starts out, and you should never lose touch with that, where when you're first starting out in comedy, like, you're looking for jokes everywhere. You're like, oh my God, what's funny about this, and what that person said, and this experience I'm doing today. And then after you've been doing it for 20, 30 years, you know, you kind of forget that little spark of magic sometimes.
Yeah, true. but do you remember, because when you're looking for jokes, obviously some work, otherwise you would have quit probably. But then there's got to be one show where nothing works at all. Do you remember the first time you bombed?
I do. There was some bombing experiences on the local open mic night comedy scene in Orlando where I started, but I was still in high school when I started. I was in 11th grade. And then when I was a senior in high school and I was 18, I started doing one-nighters around the state. That was the first time I had made a little money from it. But when I was 19, right after I graduated high school, there was, you know, comedy. It was the comedy boom in the 1980s in America. And so it was kind of the hot thing. And I was just, I was like 2 years in, and there was this, you know, Florida's kind of known for, they have a lot of strip clubs. And there's a strip club in Orlando. I can't even remember the name of it. I haven't been in a strip club in many years. Thank you, God. I forget the name of it, but this owner of this little strip club chain, and it was like one of the most popular strip clubs in Orlando, he would come to the comedy shows, and he liked me, and he offered me a trial week for $1,500 for the week to do stand-up comedy at his strip club.
That's a lot of money in the 80s.
Oh my God, at 19 years old? I mean, that's a lot of money now. And like, to go from, you know, a one-nighter that paid like $25 or like, you know, $100 if it was a good gig, that was the kind of money I was used to making at 19. And I wasn't doing it for money. I was doing it because I loved it. And I was into the experience. You know, I had read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I was just all about, you know, I wanted to be bohemian and have great life experiences and turn that into jokes and stories. So, I did this. I don't think I lasted. I think I did two nights and then they paid me in full. And they pulled it. I mean, it was the worst idea ever.
And you played in one of the strip clubs.
In the strip club, on the where the women come out and dance, they took a break. They said we're gonna have a break from the dancing, and there's the sleazy DJ, strip club guy voice is, hey, we're gonna take a break from the fur burger and thighs or whatever, all these stupid sexual innuendo jokes that the strip club DJ would say. So they introduced me, and I'm like 19. I come out there, and man, they were not having it at all. They had not. I think one of the worst things ever is you should never force comedy on people who don't want it. I think poetry is the same. You have to. It has to be an enthusiast who's there for that. So it was excruciating. And I mean, that I only had to do like 10, 15 minutes. And I remember.
Is there, apart from the money and maybe the lack of experience, but when they came up to you and said, okay, this is a deal, we're going to have naked women dancing on stage, they go off, and then you come on and do comedy.
Well, I'm forgetting a very important element to this story. So the guy was a strip club kind of mogul. He had this main club in Orlando. There was another one in Miami. He had another one in New York City. And then he had one like in Tokyo.
Of course.
The gig was, if this went well, there was a filthy comedian he had used before. And I wasn't that filthy. So it was with the promise that if this week went well, I could do these other gigs. And oh my God, $1,500 for a week? Like, that was a lot of money. So I think it was the second night. It was excruciating because the men in the audience were being tortured. Because they had gone there to see breasts, and now the breasts have been removed from the stage. So I remember there was this like drunk businessman, and he's just sitting there, and he's an absolute. He just keeps going, Diddy, Diddy. He's like. He's drunk and he keeps wailing the word titties. He just is so he can't believe that the titties have been removed from the stage. And it was horrible. Yeah. So that was one of the worst.
Oh wow.
And so yeah, the guy said thanks. He gave me the check on Wednesday. I didn't have to do it. Again, and I never. And then it was probably 25 years later before I got to go to Tokyo. So, yeah.
Oh, that's such a bad idea. But probably at that time, with $500+ a night, the best paid gigs you've ever done.
Yeah, it wasn't until like 10 years later until I made that kind of money.
Yeah, and you said. You should never force comedy onto people who don't want to.
Yeah. When I was younger, like college gigs aren't what they used to be in the States. It used to be like very cutting edge and edgy in the 90s.
My Dutch audience who might not know what a college gig is, can you explain?
Well, these universities have entertainment budgets and they have to spend them every year. So they get lots of money. You could make $5,000 for a 30-minute performance at a university. And sometimes they're in the university theater. And then other times it's in the cafeteria at lunch and they've told no one. They just like, there's a microphone in the corner. And then you feel like it's great money, but you feel like a total, you feel like you're interrupting their education, people are trying to study or whatever. Yeah. So that's forcing comedy on people who aren't ready for it.
Yeah. And same goes, I guess, for accompanied drinks or Christmas parties. Have you done those, or have you always declined doing them?
Yeah, no. In England, there used to be this comedy club chain called Junglers, and their Christmas parties were notoriously horrible.
Junglers was a chain of comedy clubs, but not necessarily for the. I don't know the right words. It's not like they were only visited by college professors, if you know what I mean. Is that right? Can you explain?
Like what not very smart audiences? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, doesn't sound very nice, but yeah.
Some of them were okay. There was a Junglers in Oxford that was pretty great, and the one in Camden Town in London was great. And they would turn into dance clubs after the comedy show. So some of them were pretty rough. I remember Nottingham. That was a pretty tough one. But I remember being in Leeds, England, in December, and it was all drunk Christmas office parties. And, you know, they get their little basket of cold chicken and cold fries, and they're drunk, and it's the worst. Yeah. I mean, that's when you, as a comedian, you know, you feel like you're blowing guys at the bus station for the money. It's you just feel like a whore. There's nothing satisfying about it.
And what point was this in your career?
I had moved to Holland in 2000, moved to Amsterdam. I had fallen in love with a Dutch woman. And at that time, there were not a lot of gigs in Holland. So, you know, to make money, I had gotten in with London. That was my key to getting with England, Europe, and the international mm-hmm. circuits. And so I was playing in London a lot. And then I was doing gigs all over England and flying back and forth from Amsterdam to England. And, so it was around that period. It was around 2000.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask, at that point, you've been doing comedy for at least 16 years. Was there...
Exactly, yeah.
What do you feel like if you've done 16 years of comedy and traveling, and then you get to one of those gigs? Aren't you inclined to just walk away and say...
I always tell young comedians, you know, no matter how good you get, there's a turd sandwich waiting for you out there somewhere. There, no matter, you know, I mean, I've seen Chris Rock bomb at the Improv, trying out new material. I mean, people are great, you know, I mean, that's been 15 years, but it can happen to the best.
Mm-hmm. And before we go back to coming to Holland and discovering what kind of clubs we had or didn't have, what was the last time you had a turd sandwich comedy wise?
This past June, I was in Atlanta. The Atlanta Punchline used to be the best club in the South. I started out on the Southern circuits. And about 10 years ago, the club moved from its freestanding building structure to the back of a diner. And it's in the back of this diner, and it's the late shows can be, drunk people. And there's a young comedian on before me. A lot of young comedians in America, to get these TikTok videos, they're doing a lot of crowd work. So everything the guy before me, he was funny, but every joke required a question to the audience.
Yeah,
and it was everything was racial. Hey, black guy. Hey, Asian guy. Hey, Mexican guy. And then he'd go into like a racial joke. And I was on like 10 minutes, and it was a really small audience. And there was this drunk Egyptian guy with a very slurry looking blonde woman. That's proper Dutch, isn't it? Slurry?
Slurry, yeah.
Yeah. And he goes, are you impressed? He goes,
I'm just thinking, of all the words you could have remembered, this is the one.
I remember a lot of good ones. Helas Pindikas. And so this Egyptian guy goes, do racist jokes like the comedian before you. And I go, I don't do racist jokes. I could do some dirty jokes for you. And I'm trying to remember all my past, you know, dirty shit from when I was younger. But it was definitely a turd sandwich.
Oh, I'm just trying to picture the scene where someone actually requests racist jokes.
Yeah, Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah.
There's some
parts of America right now that are pushing hard against political correctness by being the opposite. You know. But it's still a great club and great people that run it. It's just the location is rough and there's some, you know, weekend shows and some comedy clubs in America where just the audiences are trashed and not couth.
Couth?
Couth. Uncouth. Can you bear with me?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Now I'm just curious what the word means because I've never heard it before.
Okay, apparently I don't know how to spell it.
Or you've invented a new word.
No, uncouth. It's like uncultured.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you describe a night, what, you know, because when they're uncouth, does it mean they just, are they loud? Do they interrupt the entire time? Are they heckling? What are they doing?
No, you know, like England, I played all over England. And so, you know, they're pugilistic. They like to fight and you'll get heckled in England a lot, not because they don't like you, but just to see what you're made of, whether or not you collapse and how you're going to react to it. So there's that element sometimes when you have a comedy club with minimal security and somebody's spending money. They feel like they can yell whatever they want to the comedians.
Do you remember stuff that's been yelled at you over the past 40 years?
I've always been pretty good at crushing a heckler like a bug, but yeah, I mean,
well, because every now and then someone yells something or responds with something that's actually quite funny, and you have to give them.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, especially like if you're in Ireland, you can be heckled by someone who's funnier than you, because like. I think everyone in Ireland is hilarious. So it's funny that they import comedians. But I think one of the toughest gigs I ever did was in 2000, I had gone to the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland only to look and check it out. I wasn't even a part of it. And
that's like one of the biggest comedy festivals in the world, runs for a month.
Yeah, and it's English comedians always correct me. It's actually an arts festival. I always say it's the biggest comedy festival in the world. I always say exactly what they go. It's actually an arts festival, mate. And then there's a big comedy part to it. There's a place there called Leighton Live.
Yeah,
and it's not what it used to be, but it used to be like one of the toughest gigs on the planet, and a lot of British comedians wouldn't even do it. Because it was notorious for people going there just getting smashed drunk and heckling. So I had gone there, excuse me, and it was an all-American lineup. So this is in the year 2000, August 2000, so a year and a month before September 11th. But to give you an idea of, there was a lot of people who were anti-United States at that time. So this turned into the most anti-American rally. And the audience was going, they loved it. It was a smoky joint. Everyone's drunk. And every American comedian, it was like lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah.
And one of my oldest best friends is Rich Hall, and he was supposed to headline this show.
Great comedian.
So, yeah, great comedian. And he mysteriously says he feels like he has laryngitis, and he asked me if I would take his spot for him. And I was so young and cocky, I actually thought, fuck yeah, they're going to love me. You know, because I was, you know, to be a comedian, you kind of have to believe, you know, you have these superpowers. And I always think, you know, I can make any audience work. And so, and I was already, I don't drink anymore. I'm 10 years sober, but I was drinking and I was, you know, I was half, probably more than half drunk. And I took his spot to close this show. And it was really late. It was probably like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Close as well. Okay.
Yeah. Because it starts at midnight or later.
Yeah.
And I'm closing it. And so the sound man fucked me. I'm not like a flag waver, you know, rah-rah America guy. The sound man played, when I was introduced, he played God Bless America. So this already rabid anti-American audience lost their minds before I even got to the microphone. They're just like, fuck America, go back to America, fuck America. And it was just so, the hostility and the anger, and it was so horrible. And then I, you know, I tried to start a joke, but they're screaming, and I actually had this very serene moment. I sat down on the stage, cross-legged, and I lit a cigarette. And I just sat there, and I looked them all right in the eyes. And I'll never forget. I can picture it like it happened yesterday. This scene was so cinematic. And just these ugly, contorted faces with spittle coming out of their mouth as they're going, fuck you, fuck America, fuck America. Like, I hadn't even started. And then I got up on the mic and I go, listen, I have a drinking problem. Just let me stay up here long enough to earn my free drinks. And then that got like a little smattering of laughter. And then they kind of like, half the audience quieted down because I had this good line that they could relate to. And then whatever choice I made for the second, third jokes were the wrong choices. And, you know, I had that one split second moment where I could have turned it. But no. And it was rough. That was my, like, growing up in America, you always heard about, like, these Vietnam veterans, people who saw combat in Vietnam. They wake up in the middle of the night, and they're like, they're in sweats, and they're like, oh, they think they're back in Vietnam. For years, that was my, I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I was still on stage there being yelled at by these angry people. But I finally did the Edinburgh Festival in 2014. And I had gone there a few times through the years just to check it out and do, you know, a few sets here and there. Mm-hmm. And it's really a lot of brilliant comedians I love. I've seen go there and really beat themselves up with drinking too much. And if they're not selling tickets or getting bad reviews, they just, you know, they're... they just look so crushed. So I quit drinking.
It's a rough month because it goes on for an entire month.
And you could leave there owing $5,000 because I think it's a scam and the whole city's in on it. especially the printing places, you know, that all those little flyers and posters, and everyone leaves town, you know. In the States in August, I'll be in the audience, and there'll be Scottish people, and I'm, oh, you're renting out your place for the festival, aren't you?
Yeah.
So they all they make their money all year off this 1 month. You know, even churches leave town and they rent out their venues.
Yeah, because
in Edinburgh,
everything where nobody necessarily has to stay becomes a venue for that month.
Yeah. So I went there in 2014. I quit drinking January 2nd, 2014. And I thought, you know, now that I'm sober, I can handle this. And I went there, and I did, in the month I was there, I think I did 7 shows at Leighton Live. I was loaded for bear, as we say in America. I had stocked myself with just like the sharpest comeback lines, and just ready to be heckled. But it's not like it was.
Just mentally, or did you actually sit down and try to remember?
No. I just mentally prepared. Like I just think of every rotten thing I could possibly say to another human being and be ready to let it out. But you know, there was a little heckling, but it's not like it was 25 years ago, where it was like, it was a sport almost to go and, just fuck with a comedian's head. And, yeah, you know, so, I mean, there were great comedians in London who I told them, they said they did it once. They were humiliated and then never did it again. There's no need to do that, mate. You know?
No.
But I needed to erase this memory. So I did it like 7 times in 2014, and, you know, didn't have a problem. And, but that, when it happened in 2000, yeah, that hurt.
Yeah. Hey, Wouter hier. Weet je hoeveel geld Spotify, Apple Podcast en andere podcast apps betalen aan podcastmakers voor elke aflevering die wordt geluisterd? Exact 0,0 euro. Echt helemaal niks. Maar echt niks. Via Podimo verdient de maker, zoals ik, wel een piepklein bedrag. Elektra gaat niet achter een betaalmuur, hoor. Wees gerust. Maar als je Podimo hebt, luister Elektra dan via hun app en steun me op die manier bij het maken van de podcast. Je kan Podimo sowieso gratis een keer proberen. Doe dat als je de tijd hebt. Oké, snel weer terug.
And then you came to Holland and experienced the warmest, loveliest crowds there are.
Yeah.
Enthusiastic.
People complain about the Dutch audiences. I love the Dutch audiences, you know, because Dutch people love when you make points, or if you share a really personal insight that you've gained from your experience. It's not like sometimes in America, you know, you just feel like, jokes. And I think in Holland, you really, my experience, you know, you feel like you can open up a little bit more. I think the Dutch are conditioned with the arts, and the Dutch are conditioned with theater. So like, you can tell a story on stage in Holland in a comedy club, and like the audience will stay with you. And appreciate it. Where like sometimes in America, you know, once you, and if you're in a comedy club, like that, you know, that back of the diner gig I was talking about in Atlanta, you go into like a 3 to 5 minute story, and then, you know, you see, people getting up to go to the bathroom. Well, okay, let me check my phone, you know. I fell in love with Holland, so hard I moved there, you know? So,
okay. Because, yeah. And I think it is true what you're saying. You can tell a story and people will stay with you. But the other part is, I've done some English gigs in the past, and if I played in front of an international crowd, it always struck me that they're louder and seem to be more enthusiastic. And then you've got all the stories of other comedians coming to Holland. Steve Hughes got the joke where he says, oh, the Dutch, they'll stare at you and make a grown man cry.
The Dutch are great. If you make them laugh, they'll laugh. If you don't, they'll stare at you until you cry.
Yeah. That's the one.
Yeah, I've talked to, you know, some American comedians through the years who went to Holland, and they just like, oh my God, those were the worst audiences I've ever played to. But I just don't think they understand that, you know, for some Dutch people, the, you know, they're converting the language in their brain. You know, it's not that they're not enjoying it. It's just that, you know, maybe you lost them by talking too fast. Who knows what? Mm. You know?
So if it wasn't the Dutch, what's the worst audience you can imagine? Are there countries around the world where you rather not go, or if you go there, think, oh, I have to prepare?
Maybe it's changed, but many years ago, I did shows in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. I think I would skip that one. Yeah. I mean, it's not... I don't know. Human rights.
Good point.
You know, and it's, you can't really condemn
that's a country, not an audience, or
based, you know, based on a couple of shitty gigs. You know, I mean, these were gigs that were booked out of London, and it was mostly drunk English expat people. So, you know, maybe it's a great place.
Yeah. No, because every now and again, people or comedians in Holland will say, oh, I'd prefer this region over that region, or I don't want to go up to, you know, the north of Holland because people are more quiet. And then you go there, you do a show, and they're fine, and it's lovely. Or you go
I had not been to Europe and Holland in 5 years because of the pandemic. And last November, I came over and did shows. And it's amazing what is happening in Holland now with, there's little comedy clubs everywhere. Like there's a great little club in Breda. I mean, there used to be like bar gigs around Holland, you know? Holy moly. Oh my God, what a great room. And so there's all these different great comedy clubs that used to not be there. And, you know, there's just places in, I mean, I love Holland. Your country was so good to me, and it changed me who I am as a person, as a human being, as a comedian. And so for the rest of my life, Holland has always been magic for me. I had two beautiful love stories with women. Well, maybe three. because I fell in love with a woman when I they made me move there, and then later I married a woman from Rotterdam. We're divorced. She's still my best friend, and I got to experience Holland on such a deep level that even most Dutch people wouldn't experience it. When I had my late night talk show on Dutch television, and a big part of it was I was a foreigner experiencing Dutch culture. So everything was explained to me, the drug laws, the, you know, Polder Model and all the everything. and having all these guests on, politicians, writers, and it's amazing. So I love the whole country and different regions, but there's certain places like Enschede. Oh my God, there's this little theater at the university there, and I'm playing there and end of November, beginning of December. I don't know that, I forget. Well, hold on.
I'm trying really hard to think of the name of the theater at the TU Twente.
That's it. And, you know, like I was in American universities have changed. Now the comedians that go to universities in America are like bland, unoffensive. They're like really touchy. And not even like woke culture, like conservative culture also. Like everyone is so touchy at a university now in the States. And, you know, I haven't done one in years here. But the audiences are always amazing there. Just young, intelligent. Wow. I mean, I love, you know, Eindhoven to Hexa. You know, so, I love, I'm going to Maastricht. Oh my God, one of my favorite places on the planet Earth. It's such an honor to get to perform in Maastricht. And like most American or even European comedians, they don't know these places. Groningen, if I ever moved back to Europe, I think it might be Delft or Groningen. They're just absolute perfect places to live your life, I think.
Both very nice cities, yeah. But what kind of shows did you do when you were in Holland? You said you flew back and forth to England, but before, I assume you did live shows.
Because there was Tumler and the Comedy Cafe in Amsterdam. Those were basically the main clubs. And only in the summer does Tumler have English-speaking comedians. So, you know, there wasn't any work. Before I got the television show, which started in 2002 in January. So from 2000 to 2002, I had to go back and forth to England all the time make money.
Because you mentioned the bar shows, did you do those, or?
That came later. That came around 2002 in Holland, and like bar shows started popping up.
So what's the worst show you've ever done in Holland? Because you've mentioned all these places where you said, oh, they're lovely. I might even, if I'd ever move to Europe, I'd go there. Are there places in Holland you
it wasn't a comedy gig. It wasn't a comedy gig. It was, there was a gig in Rotterdam at, it's a beach themed bar. I don't even know if it exists anymore.
By a beach club, probably.
That's it. That's it.
Because it was a very big and popular club.
Yeah. So, and it wasn't a comedy show. I had been, I had the TV show. And I had gotten an offer to host a bikini contest. So how can you fuck that up? It was my fault 100%. I drank too much and I was very drunk. So, but I wasn't doing comedy, you know, but I just remember that.
And then how did the show go?
It wasn't good. I mean, I only had to do like 5 minutes of stand up at the front, and I was sloppy. I was horrible. And, yeah, I mean, you should never look down on a gig. I thought, oh, it's a bikini thing, and oh, you know, it's good money. I'll just go there and pick up this thing. I should have been more professional. It was 100% my fault, and I was mortified when I came off stage and Katja Sherman was there and had seen me be a fucking drunk moron.
And when they approached
you... it wasn't a comedy show. And then it was funny, too. Like, when I had the late night talk show, I used to make a lot of jokes about Rotterdam. And because my musical sidekick, Elife, was from Rotterdam. Oh. So...
Yeah,
I used to make fun of it, and then I, you know, ended up marrying a woman from Rotterdam. I've spent a lot of time in Rotterdam in the last 20 years, and especially in the last 10 years, Rotterdam has become the coolest city in Europe.
It's very cool, yeah.
Rotterdam is so unbelievably cool. I mean, I could probably live in Rotterdam, too. I think it's, especially what they've done on the south of Rotterdam. Just so many cool restaurants and bars, and it's artsy, it's ethnic, it's everything I love, you know, international. And so going there a lot in the last 20 years, seeing that Baja Beach Club passing it, it was like cringe and just think, you know, that it was my fault, 100%. It was my fault.
I do like how...
who knows? Maybe if I'd have, you know, showed up sober with some good jokes prepared, I'd be on a couch with three kids that look half like Katja Sherman.
I didn't know she was there. I would have, you know.
I would have tried harder if I'd have known, you know, the hottest woman in Holland was there.
Yeah. I do like the fact that performing in clubs between women in or probably without bikinis is a theme within your career.
I didn't realize that. That's my bookends of worst gigs ever. Yeah. So, yeah, I should stay away from bikini situations.
Yeah. One last thing that I wanted to ask you about, because we talked about forcing comedy upon people. The Christmas parties in the UK. But have you done like corporate shows? Because that's the ultimate form of forcing comedy onto people.
Those are always the worst gigs in America. I never did them because you always have to be squeaky clean and not controversial at all. So I never did any, you know, because I was never trying to be a clean comedian. Now, as I've gotten older, it's funny, like when you're younger as a comedian, you know, you do dirty jokes because it gets a laugh. Yep. And, you know, like that moment I had in Atlanta, oh, let me try and think of, you know, old dirty jokes. And then, you know, they worked. It's not for the thinking person. But as I've gotten older, I'm trying to do the smartest material I can and talk about, you know, share a knowledge and my travel experiences and things. What was the question?
About corporate gigs. You said I never did them
in
America.
The only time I ever did corporate gigs was in Holland. And they were some of the greatest experiences I've ever had in my life. So, like, I never did corporate gigs in America. But in Holland, oh my God, I did one for, and they were great. I did one for it was the train services.
Nationale Spoorwegen, NS?
NS, but they were with, it was other train people from around Europe. And it was so smartly done, the way they had planned this. It was an evening of meals. You were taking a train journey around Europe, and I hosted it, you know, and I had gone there and practiced with the executives or whoever from NS was putting it on. Phenomenal. One of the best, it should have been filmed as a TV show. The concept of it was great. They had screens up. You're on a train journey, and then I was introducing, I would, you know, make a joke or two about the country we're arriving in, and then this meal comes. I did a private gig for Philips in Eindhoven once that was phenomenal. Great money. It's a thrill to go to the Philips complex, and it was where their development stuff was happening.
Yeah.
So it was a private gig for the engineers who were the creators of Philips projects.
And this was before they created the respirator machines with all the problems they have now.
Oh, I didn't hear about that.
Oh, well, it's a long story short.
Hey,
they've got respirators and there's foam inside of it to keep them quiet. And even years ago, some technician said, the foam is coming off and it's causing disease and a lot of nasty stuff for people using them. And then, of course, people involved with money said, yeah, just keep quiet about it. And now it's going to cost them millions and millions.
Well, as long as their record players are working, that's how I feel. I'm kidding. No, I did not hear about that.
No, never mind.
And then... There was a great little family-owned electronics company out of Eindhoven. And I did once a year for 3 years. I hosted their, this like corporate thing they did where they would introduce their new products. And it was really, what was the name of it? I wish I could honor this woman by remembering the name of it, but... I would rehearse with the people Because like these Dutch developers, like English wasn't their first language, and then like they're like little scientist people. So like they're not used to being in front of an audience. So we recreated my late night talk show to introduce the products, and I would bring out the developers. But for a week before the gig, 3 years in a row, I would sit down with these people and we'd work out the questions, and I would tell all of them, look, you know, I'm not gonna make you uncomfortable or make you look bad. The whole idea is to make you look great. And what question can I ask you that will, so that you can shine? And it was always fantastic. And it was 3 years in a row. Oh my God, I wish I could remember the name of it. The woman's father had died. It was, and she took it over. Just total badass power woman. Typical Holland story. Just like a great dedicated family. With, you know, a brilliant company they made from scratch.
But all these gigs are usually the opposite of your typical corporate gig, because they were well organized. Probably, you know, light and sound were done well.
Light and sound were amazing, and they treated them all, the theme, they treated it all like it was a television taping. They knew to rehearse for a week before the event. I've never done any other corporate events. Like, you always hear about these nightmare stories, but
yeah, they are.
And the only corporate shows I've ever done were in Holland, and they were amazing.
Wow.
There was another, what was it called? Suit Club or something like that at a Rotterdam. No. It was it was like dashing Dutch well-dressed men. It was a club. It was called Suit Club. It was cool business guys. Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were going to tell a story about how you did a gig there.
No. Those are the only corporate gigs I've ever done. And they were all phenomenal. Yeah. So I have nothing bad to say.
It's unique. A comedian. I've had comedians on who've either never did corporate gigs because they were smart enough not to do them.
Yeah.
And then you've got the type of comedians, I think some of them you probably remember from when you lived here, who do loads of them and are really well at them.
But yeah, I think it takes a certain kind of comedian. Yeah. Well, it's funny. In my experience with Holland is I've heard comedians go, oh my God, those were the worst audiences. I'd never go back. I never had that problem.
It probably helped that you were American as well, or international. So that gives a sense of, ooh, we've got... And they knew you off of television.
For those corporate gigs. Yeah. But as a comedian, I fell in love with the country. And, before the television happened, I just wanted to learn everything, you know? So, I don't know.
And then you got to learn it on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. How was that? Because I assumed you had some writers for the show.
Yes. Yeah. A handful of writers. And it was great because I had had a sitcom in America and it was called Mr. Rhodes. And I played a school teacher. And the show had nothing to do with who I was as a person. I had all these writers and then they wouldn't even give me jokes. I had to give nice advice to the kids, and I was young and skinny and I had really long hair, so it was all hair jokes. Come, hey Kenny G, hey Fabio, hey Cream Rinse, every dumb. So that was like really frustrating, and I had made a truckload of money doing that show. And then the opposite was I go to Holland and I have this late night talk show, and I could completely be myself. It wasn't for American television money. Yeah, that's the thing. So it was it was Kevin Masters. I had to have a different name, but I could do whatever I wanted. And then for the monologue jokes, it was really fun. All the writing staff, they would clip newspaper stories, from the Volkskrant and, Het Parool, wherever. And they one at a time during the week. Every day I'd sit down with one of them and they would go through the news clippings of me and we would try and come up with jokes that way. And yeah.
No, I was wondering, did you ever, I can imagine, you know, one in, well, the jokes that end up in the script usually work in rehearsal as well. So they're not likely to bomb, but I was wondering, did you ever do a joke that bombed and you just didn't know the backstory to it or didn't understand why it bombed because you didn't know?
No, not because of not knowing the backstory. I didn't get to run them in front of an audience before that. I mean, you know, some of the jokes would, you know, a lot of them, I'd say half bombed. That's kind of like the fun of a late night talk show. And then the host comments on them not working. but no, it was really just, it was fun. It was fun to sit down with the Dutch news every day, like different writers. There was one woman I really loved, Hilde Brontsema. She's gone into nonprofit work. And, you know, okay, here's a story. This happened in, you know, Endrikito Ambacht or somewhere like that, or you know, and we would try and come up with jokes from it. It was great.
Cool. What are the and then we'll probably round up, I guess. What's the weirdest conditions you've ever performed under? Because usually comedy gets booked, you know, for music festivals, and then you go to a club and it turns out to be just a raggedy shag in the back of a garden somewhere.
I've done music festivals and it's, you know, they don't factor in the fact that it's a tent and sound is coming through the canvas tent. I've done things like that. Did toughest circumstances?
It doesn't even have to mean the show went bad, because I've done shows where I came to the gig and thought this is impossible, and it turned out to be great, even though you're in the middle of a field with a wooden stage and just 12 people in front of it.
Yeah, you never know. Like about 10 years ago, I did a gig in Thailand in Phuket, and it was an outdoor gig, and I was headlining, and the opening act was a local high school rock and roll band. Okay, so it's an outdoor gig in a parking lot, and the opening act is a high school rock and roll band. Okay, this is going to be the worst gig ever. No, it was one of the greatest gigs ever. I didn't know, I think it's on the north part of Phuket. There's like an area where a lot of expatriates live, and it's families and a lot of like kind of suburban homes. So it was in that area. And a lot of the parents were like airline pilots. Their planes were going, their main hub was Hong Kong, but it was too expensive to live with their families in Hong Kong. So they lived in Phuket in paradise, and then they would fly to Hong Kong. That's where a lot of the people were. So the promoter was from India, and this man had done mostly music shows, and the stage, it was outdoors around the edges of the stage. He had put potted flowers because this is how he presented shows in India. And like, as goofy as that sounds, it was a really lovely touch.
Yeah.
And it made the stage look beautiful. And it was like 300 people. It was sold out. And the high school rock and roll band was amazing. And then while I was on stage, I felt like Richard Pryor at the Hollywood Bowl or something. They were phenomenal. They were great.
Oh, wow. It was fantastic.
You know, my favorite kind of audience is multinational, multi-ethnic, and you know, fairly educated that know things. And that's what this audience was, and they were great. You know, all my best, funniest stories about traveling the world, and there was a lot of Dutch people there. So I talked about living in Holland and, you know, it sounded like it would be the worst gig ever, but it was the best. You just never know. Like when people go in comedy, it's a small world, you know, like you'll hear other comedians go, oh, that guy's an asshole. And you meet the guy and he's like the nicest guy in the world. And then it works the other way too. You hear people go, oh, that guy's such a great guy. And then you meet him and he's a dick to you. I mean, you never know. That's the exciting thing about comedy, you know? It can be whatever. I'll tell you a funny story that last year, I did a set in Amsterdam, and there was a young American comedian there. I think the guy, he told me he'd been on comedy for like 6 months or something. And he was giving himself a little too much credit. He was saying, I'm really just glad to be living in Amsterdam doing stand-up. I heard that they just got stand-up comedy here a few years ago. really? Yeah. I go, well, that's not true. Because the first time I came to Amsterdam was to perform at Tumler, and I think that was 1999. And they've had English-speaking comedy every summer for maybe 30, 40 years. And the Comedy Cafe's been around for a long time. And 20 years ago, I had a late-night talk show on Dutch television, and we featured stand-up comedy on that. So I think it's been around... Stand-up comedy's been in Holland for longer than 2 years. The guy, you know, he was kind of saying, like, he was a pioneer, you know? He was helping launch this genre of art. And then he went on, and he ate a very deserved turd sandwich, that shit. But I just thought it was like that typical kind of American arrogance. You're like, this guy has no fucking idea what he's talking about. And he thinks that he is... bringing stand-up comedy to the Netherlands. Great.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for making it like a full circle with a turd sandwich.
Yeah.
Dat was hem, de Elektra podcast. Meer informatie over mijn gast van vandaag en linkjes naar van alles en nog wat vind je in de omschrijving van deze aflevering. Er staan ongelooflijk veel afleveringen online van Elektra en op elektrapodcast.nl kan je makkelijk zoeken op de naam van jouw favoriete comedians en cabaretiers. Je kan daar ook eenmalig doneren of crewmember worden. Als crewmember betaal je maandelijks een klein bedrag, maar dan krijg je ook nog eens bonusmateriaal, je luistert voortaan zonder onderbrekingen en je krijgt consumptiebonnen die je kan inleveren bij een show van mij. Ik vind het sowieso te gek als je een keer komt kijken bij mij, dus ga naar woutermonde.nl, daar zie je precies waar en wanneer ik optreed. Of meld je aan voor de nieuwsbrief, dan hou ik je op die manier op de hoogte. En dan nog iets, elke vrijdagmorgen doe ik een column op radiostation Kink. Je kan die column terugluisteren als podcast. Hij heet Kink op de Week en je vindt hem in de app waar je ook deze podcast luistert. Oké, tot de volgende Elektra. Hoi!